Hello and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Today, we're conducting another exploration into the island's Mukai Farm and Gardens. The Friends of Mukai, a collection of talented and accomplished islanders that includes folks of Japanese descent, has been working to restore the Mukai property to its original 1920s glory. They've had great success with the house and garden. The next step is to restore the on-site barreling plant. Here to tell us about it is one of Mukai's most steadfast friends. She is Lynn Greiner. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you for having me.
It's so good to see you, and so good to see what's been happening with the Mukai Farm and Gardens. But for those of our listeners who may not be familiar, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little history of the barreling plant.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, it's tied into the whole site. So the property of 40 plus acres that the barreling plant sits on, and the Mukai house and the surrounding Japanese garden, was part of the bigger acreage that B.D. Mukai and his wife Kuni and their 16-year-old son purchased in 1926. The family had farmed strawberries on the island for 10-ish years as tenants, but they couldn't buy property because of alien exclusion laws, because they were Japanese immigrants. So when their son Masa turned 16, they were able to buy the property, the acreage, in his name. And that was an exciting development for them. They were skilled strawberry farmers, but I think they really wanted the property in order to process berries. And so the first thing that they built was the fruit barreling plant, which is if you haven't been to Mukai, it's on 107th Southwest, west of town, and kind of at the end of the road down there. And the barreling plant is a 6,000-ish square foot agricultural building. Experts, historic preservationists, tell us that it is the only remaining intact Japanese farm from that era in the United States. Typically, Japanese immigrants back then didn't build things. They wanted to fit in, so they just used existing structures. So the fact that they built the barreling plant and then the house and then the Japanese garden is remarkable for that time period.
6,000 square feet. I didn't realize it's that big.
It's huge. It's massive. Yes.
The Mukais were obviously entrepreneurial types.
Totally. Yes. They were, besides farming, they were primarily, as I said, into processing berries. I can talk about that. There was a whole network of strawberry farmers on Vashon, many of Japanese immigrants also, and even others around the area. And they, in order to make the most of their berries, the Mukai set up the processing plant. So other berry farmers brought their berries there. And the process itself involved packing berries and sugar into 500-pound barrels. So you've probably all seen big barrels. So that's what the Mukais did. Half sugar, well, two parts berries to one part sugar. And then they, I think, shipped them to Seattle where they were frozen. And then they were shipped all over the country, New York, Southern California. It was really the leading edge of frozen food. This was in the late 1920s and throughout the 1930s.
You know, and I'm surprised, here's how ignorant I am, to know that I didn't think they were able to do massive freezing of anything in the 1920s. But apparently there was freezer technology, if you will, available in Seattle.
Yes, there was, right.
But so, Mukai's process with the sugar was innovative. That was not done before.
Right, and the 500, the big barrels, yes, was a way to ship lots and lots of berries. We've heard tell that the Smuckers had received Mukai berries. We're trying to document that for sure, but people have told us that that berry source was really important to the Smucker family. strawberry jam.
Huh. So Vachon strawberries have gone around the world, if you will.
Yes, they have. And the type of berries that the Mukais grew are Marshall strawberries, which apparently are very sweet but have a short shelf life. So they needed to process them quickly in order to preserve them. So that was another reason to develop that innovative processing mechanism.
Was that the first time sugar was used as a preservative?
That I don't know. I bet not. But maybe on that scale for berries, yes.
That's pretty remarkable. So yeah. I believe that the strawberry farmers on the island had a festival. Did they call it the Strawberry Festival, or did that come later?
I think that came a bit later, but that would be a question for a historian.
But it's certainly the source of our yes. Strawberry Festival, which has been an established event on Vachon Island probably since the 20s.
Right. We do have a really great photo of a Mukai truck decorated that was in the Strawberry Festival. And I think that photo's from the 1930s. So yes, I think they were part of it.
So this was 20-some years of strawberry processing and really a big industry here on Vachon Island. Do you have any sense of the impact that the Mukai's entrepreneurship had on the overall economy of the island at the time?
Well, let me just back up on the 20-something years. So they purchased the farm in 26 and erected the barreling plant in 27. But then in 1942, when the FDR did the Executive Order 9066, which was the internment order, the Mukais were so well connected and wealthy that they got advance notice of that order from some military person that they were friends with. So they fled to Idaho, where I think Moss's wife's family lived. So they basically hid out there for 4 years. So really it was, well, we can do the math. It was less than 20 years,
yeah, yeah,
20,
right.
26, 27, up until 1942.
And everything came to a screeching halt in 42?
They did have caretakers, but for a various number of reasons, including their absence, the momentum of the berry farm just couldn't sustain itself. There were also, during that time period when they were away, apparently the California berry market was picking up and roads were improving, so transport was. So there were a number of reasons why the berry farm wasn't the same after they returned in 46. But I think it's striking to know that during the 1930s, during the Depression, mm-hmm. at the height of the season, they employed over 400 people to help process berries, which included picking their own berries, but also processing the berries. So for months and months, seasonally, they were a huge employer on Vachon. And people came from far away. We know of Native American people coming down from Canada to help with the harvest and the processing, and people all over the region. So it was a big enterprise.
And it sounds like they helped Vachon make it through the Depression.
Yes, right. Through employing a lot of people and keeping the berry. Yes.
And essentially, I would guess, the economy of Vachon moving.
Yes, right.
I'm curious about their self-evacuation to Idaho. My understanding of the internment process was that it was a sweep of the entire West Coast.
Correct.
Idaho is not considered part of that.
Right. Even, I think, even Spokane wasn't involved in it. It was, the boundary was really coastal. So, yes. So they were in Dead Ox Flats, Idaho, which was just on the border, I think, maybe of Oregon and Idaho.
Yeah, in Oregon, there's some folks in Oregon who just today submitted a bill wanting to make themselves part of Idaho. Conservative counties in Oregon, that's an aside.
Yes.
Idaho is known to be conservative, and apparently those Oregonians who are conservative want to go there.
Yes. Oh, boy.
So the Mukais hid out for 4 years undetected in Idaho.
Actually, they did pretty well over there, too. Very enterprising family. They were responsible for, I've heard stories about this, doing a massive, I'm not sure if garden is the right word, but they grew crops over there, too, and planted things and really helped that community out, too, while they were there. So
they're immortalized in Dead Ox, Idaho as well. Yeah, as entrepreneurs. What an incredible family.
Yes.
So they were among the few who actually returned after the internment was over.
Only about a third of Vashon people with Japanese ancestry came back. Yes.
And why was that?
Well, they had caretakers that did monitor the farm and do some production. So they did have something to come back to. And of course, they had the house. And I think somewhat of a community. So they came back and farmed some, but then they got into other kinds of businesses. They did some construction work. I think Masa Mukai had, it was called Vipco, Vashon Island. I'm not sure what the P is, but they did septic design and installation. So I think he was engineer-ish. He had a lot of skills and interests and abilities. So they molded with the times.
And of course, when you mentioned that the proliferation or the growth of transport in California and farming in California affected the success, if you will, of strawberry farming on Vashon and strawberry processing, I'm an old reporter and I start thinking, follow the money. Who was benefiting from the Japanese families leaving this island and leaving their farms and taking advantage of the increase in transport? Were there any folks on Vashon who maybe took advantage of the fact that they had an opportunity to be caretakers?
Well, there were people. There was an island resident, Tootie Blickfield, and there's a photo in the Mukai house of Tootie's, I think, her grandfather, and she's in it too as a child. And I know that Mr. Blickfield was one of the caretakers, and they were friends, so I don't know about taking advantage of, but keeping it going and operational to some extent.
So those, if you know, those two-thirds of Japanese farmers, Vashon farmers, who did not return, what happened to their property?
I am not sure. There is a whole map now of historic Japanese farms on the island, and I think there's varying stories. Some people came back and did other things, but some of the properties were sold, and people didn't return to Vashon and farming life. I think it was a time when the people who were interned had to make lots of decisions. There were manufacturing jobs that were available in the Midwest and East Coast. Some did that. I think people just scattered.
Yeah, and when they were interned, the Vashon community of Japanese folks, unlike many others, was not contained.
Right.
They were scattered, yeah.
That's right.
So they must have had to go elsewhere.
Yes. Very sad legacy, yes.
It is a sad legacy. Heartbreaking, actually, that an entire community could be erased.
Well, and they were so connected to the Vashon community during the late 20s and 30s. If you look at high school yearbooks from back then, there's a lot of kids of Japanese heritage, and they're involved in everything. And the Mukais themselves had... Their farm was really a gathering place. We have all kinds of photos of them having parties and teas and weddings and events. They were community-minded.
And they supported the schools and the construction of the schools and donated to those things.
Right.
A lot of those things we wouldn't have without them having been here.
That's right.
So let's go to the barreling plant. This is your baby, I take it.
one of the babies. So just a quick word about Friends of Mukai has
been
involved with the restoring, preserving, and operating the Mukai Farm and Garden really since 2012. And so we finished restoration. We got site control of the house and garden, which is owned by Friends of Mukai, which is a Washington State nonprofit. So the Friends owns the house and garden, and we restored those two things, that whole parcel, 2 years ago, 2019, with a lot of public money. A shout out to the state and to King County and to community donors who made that possible. So that work is all finished, and it was always our vision to acquire the barreling plant too and reunite the two parcels, which would together would be about 5 acres, which is a small portion of the original 40 plus acres, mm-hmm. but the most historically intact. Both the barreling plant and the house garden parcel are on the National Register of Historic Places.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Yes, and King County landmarked. So it's always been our vision to get the barreling plant, and in 2016 or 17, the state legislature in their capital budget appropriated $350,000 with a big shout out to Sharon Nelson.
Wow.
helped get that amount of money, and then we raised $50,000. So with the $400,000 that we came up with, we gave that to King County, which wanted to own the barreling plant as part of their parks portfolio. So Friends owns the house and garden, Parks owns the barreling plant. Friends of Mukai has a use agreement with King County to operate the whole site together. So our long-term goal to unify the two parcels and operate them as one has been realized. And so as part of that, securing the barreling plant, then the next step was to fix it up. It's 90 years old, showing its age. So that's what we've been working on for the past 2 years.
So would it be fair to say that you are now part of King County Parks?
Well, that parcel is, but the lease agreement, the use agreement, gives Friends total responsibility for raising all the money, hiring the contractor, supervising the contractor, hiring the architect, making sure the construction is done according to National Historic Standards. And then once the restoration is finished, we have authority to operate the barreling plant as well.
That's an unusual, a lot of work.
It's an unusual relationship, but our King County partners are terrific. So it's been great.
So let's back up just a bit before we go to what happens next. Do you know how many iterations that 6,000 square foot barreling plant has had over the years?
I am not sure. Before King County bought it, the kids' softball league, there were batting cages in there.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure who was behind that, whether it was a school district or really who.
I think that was a park district baseball club.
There you go. Okay, so that was in there. And then before that, I've heard rumor that there were some little shops or flea market. And
yeah,
I really don't know before that.
And I think it may have lain fallow for a while.
Yes.
Before that. And who owned it before you guys got King County to buy it? Who actually owned the property?
Frank Zellerhoff. Zellerhoff Construction owned it for a while, for a few years. And we worked with Frank. He was a good neighbor to the house and gardens and helped participate in the sale of it to King County. And before Frank, I am not sure. I haven't seen the lineage.
I don't know that it has a checkered history, but certainly a history. So tell us now, what's going to happen next? What can we expect from this huge, I'm still shocked at how big it is, this huge building?
Well, so we just 3 weeks ago finished phase one construction, and there's two phases. So we raised $900,000, thanks to the state and King County, to stabilize it. So phase one is stabilization. So it is 90 years old, was listing, seriously, if you were, if you had gone out there in the past couple of years, you would see that it was tilting towards 107th. So we hired, well, we've been working for 2 years with a really great architectural firm, Building Work. They did the renovation of Camp South 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
They just finished Town Hall in Seattle. They work on a lot of major restoration projects all in the region. Really great architectural firm. So we hired them a couple years ago to help figure out what repairs it needed. We also, a couple of years ago, connected with a really amazing project manager, Kai Kelly, who happens to live on Vashon. He is the executive director of Historic Seattle. And Historic Seattle does a lot of securing, purchasing historic properties and then turning them into public entities. Like if you're familiar with Seattle, the Good Shepherd Center or Washington Hall. So Kai, this is his wheelhouse. So he's been the project manager. He actually helped us choose Building Work. We interviewed 5 or 6 architectural firms with Kai's guidance, hired Building Work. So we secured the money to do phase one, and we started that in December in the worst weather possible and during a pandemic.
Right.
And for 3 months, CDK Construction out of Duval, a commercial construction company, was at the barreling plant, and they reinforced the pier supports underneath. They took off the whole west side, which was caving in, leaning. They straightened that up. They straightened up the loading dock. They basically straightened up the whole building. They replaced a lot of failing siding. They put on a new roof with insulation underneath it. They painted the back half of the barreling plant. Like I said, they just left a couple of weeks ago. So it's actually much more stable than ever.
That's an incredible amount of work.
Yes.
Does that then make it seismically stable? Are there standards, seismic standards, that a building like that has to pass?
Yes. And because this was done over the winter and it was very rainy in January, mm-hmm. we all realized that the building actually is sitting on soil that's mushy. So it's helped us determine that we need for phase two, which will finish the building off and get it ready for tenants to come in and do tenant improvements. We realize we need to actually stabilize the flooring foundation even more with pin piles. Granted, that was a super rainy month, but now we know, and so
good,
it's helped us figure mm-hmm. out what we need to do for phase two.
Have you learned a whole lot about construction in this process?
Yes, we had.
You're talking the lingo pretty well.
We had weekly meetings with CDK and Kai and the architectural team, and I learned about change orders and cost estimates, and it was actually fun and interesting and productive all.
How much of your time, Lynn Griner, have you been putting into this project?
I do not even want to count. A lot.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah.
So much.
And how many folks are there on your Friends of Mukai committee who are responsible specifically for the barreling plant?
Well, our work group includes Kai and then Kate Weiland, who's the main architect from Building Work. And then 2 people from King County are on that. And I think there's 6 Mukai people that are on it. So that's 10. And then when we had the CDK people, 13. So we'd have a lot of Zoom meetings, Friday morning, 9:30 Zoom meetings every week.
Right.
To monitor what was going on there. Yeah.
And you are a retired attorney, correct?
I do a little work still.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure that skill has helped.
Yes. So moving forward.
Yes.
So now we want to finish it off, and now we have a good task list of what is necessary for that. So we will do new flooring, drop the floor, put a concrete pad in there, and then get HVAC in there and bathrooms and a new septic field. And there's a list of about 20 things that need to happen.
Well, so you mentioned tenants. What kind of building is this going to be when it's all finished?
Well, because it was an agricultural building, Friends of Mukai's long-term goal was to return it to that purpose. And we have found a tenant, the anchor tenant for a lot of it that we think is perfectly suited. And that's our neighbor, Dragon's Head Cider.
Oh.
And coincidentally and happily, a lot of Dragon's Head Cider apple trees are on the former strawberry acreage of the Mukai's. And Dragon's Head needs a bigger space and a covered space. And so we've been meeting with them now for a couple of years. So the back part of the building will house their big cider tanks and a lot of their production work. And we'll have a tasting room in there too.
Interesting. And, so is this going to be what could be called a public building?
Yes.
Are there going to be other tenants?
Yes. And then there's room. There's a big south room. There's room there for another tenant, and we're casting about for another agricultural-based tenant to be in there. And then we also want, though, there to be a lot of public space. So Dragon's Head has been great saying, yes, we'll have historic exhibits in there and interpretive information about what happened when the Mukai's owned it so that people understand the history while they're sipping their cider. that would be a condition for the tenant for the south building too. And then the loading dock will be all public use, and we think it's the perfect stage for parties and music and theater.
Outdoor theater. Vashon Repertory Theater would like to know about that.
Yes. And ideally tenants could even wander in the tasting room and they'll move over, or the other part of the building too, and the bathrooms will be open. So yes.
What an incredible gift the Friends of Mukai are giving to our community and to the region. And we are about out of time. In the last 30 seconds that we have, Lynn Greiner of Friends of Mukai, what do you want people to know? How do I apply to be a tenant?
You can just look on our website, Mukai Farm and Garden. You can see who the board members are. Hopefully many of them are known to Vashonites. So just talk to anyone. So yes, we're looking for tenants, good ideas, and we hope that in 2022 we'll be finished and it'll be operational and be part of the whole campus. So people will come to it for any number of events or parties or workshops or classes or lectures or music or whatever, and amble around. And most importantly, learn about the incredible history of the Mukai's and how their presence on Vashon has benefited us to this day.
And you're kind of bringing them back to us. Thank you, Lynn Greiner.
Yes, thank you for having us. And stop by Mukai if you haven't been there. It's open to the public all the time.
Thank you. You've been listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday, where curiosity chases truth. And I'm so grateful for your spending a half hour with me.